The 2024 Banking with Life Client Only event is coming up this October, Friday the 25th, Saturday the 26th. I'm excited to see you, excited to share the news with you.
How many people were there last year?
A little over 130.
How many states?
22 to 23.
Yeah. Okay. So the only kind of event where you've got the minority, really the minority, right? Y'all see what's going on social media and online with how IBC and the language of banking is being used. You know that what you're doing is different, and there is one opportunity in the year to go hang out with a bunch of other people who are all doing something very similar. I don't think you should miss it.
You shouldn't miss it. I mean, it's going to be full of educational talks. You know, breakfast, lunch, the details will be forthcoming in an email, gives you the opportunity to register. And so I don't want to get deep into the details, but I'm telling you, a room full of like-minded people that are not ashamed to be paying premium, actually controlling the banking function. And last year, Ryan, we had clients that were maybe a month or two brand new clients clients that were 10 or 12 years practicing.
Yeah.
So there's a broad array of people from all over the country doing different things, but they're all focused on controlling the banking function in their life properly, correctly.
Yeah.
And that's exciting. That's a big deal. I don't know where you can go and find that many people in one room.
Yeah. And had the opportunity to hear directly from number one, number two, I mean, senior executive leadership at a company that a lot of our clients own. You know, in what other domain of finance today does that ever happen? And nobody go and meet the head of some index fund, okay, or the guys who write up the 401k plans. But you get that here. You hear directly from the people who work at and are in charge of the companies themselves. You meet other people, like you said, brand new clients, people who've been doing it for over a decade. None of this. Look, there's plenty of places. You want to go do the crypto. You want to go do the real estate investing and do into the new flashy, fun things that are really great to sell you right down a river. There's a lot of that out there. People have a lot of opportunity to go do that. This is not that. It's a nice little break from that. If you were there last year, you know, the venue was very nice. It's a great time to be in Texas in October. I enjoyed it. You know, it'll be a good time.
Ryan's book will be out. The opportunity to get it autographed. Other new merch. I'm looking forward to it. You know, the first one, this will be the third one. The first one was really good. You know, 100 people there, 20 different states. More people were there last year in the second one, more states. I think this one is going to be bigger and better.
Yeah.
Regardless of how many people come, I'm excited about the talks and the people talking.
Yeah.
The team will be there. You'll be able to get to meet them. I know most of you have, a lot of you have met them, and all of you, all of our clients have spoken with them. But to be able to meet them it's a great opportunity.
Former podcast guests, you know, they come.
Oh yeah.
And it's for clients of James Nethery and for my clients. And again, details will be in the email. Sign up will be through email. Last time we had a lot of questions about where's the link? It'll be provided by email. Okay. There is no public page because it's not for the public. It'll be sent directly to you. All right.
Yeah. The only agents that'll be there will be zero outside agents, but there are agents that are affiliated with my office and they'll be there and their clients.
Yeah.
And it's not a sales fest. You know, it's not come and see the next great thing to, you know, be pressured into purchasing before you have a birthday or whatever.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty cool. Calm, cool, relaxed, and educational and fun. Did I mention fun? Yeah, it'll be fun. I assure you. Okay. Hope to see you there.
See you there.
In this episode, Ryan and I discussed the conventional financial planning construct of protection, accumulation, and distribution. Thanks for listening. Welcome to the Banking with Life podcast. I'm your host, James Nethery.
I'm your co-host, Ryan Griggs.
And we're sitting here having fun on a Saturday morning at the world headquarters of Banking with Life, 20, 25 miles south of Fort Worth in an undisclosed location. And I have to say, so Mr. Griggs, he spends an hour on a good day, good traffic, driving down here, and very appreciative of you taking your time to make that happen. And he generally listens to something that often winds up as a basis or part of conversation that we may have and record and invite you to enjoy if you wish. However, we have just spent about 45 minutes to an hour talking about a lot of really good things and exciting things that completely blew what I thought I might want to talk about. So,
what did you originally think you wanted to talk about?
Well, I didn't really know. I don't generally come in here with a topic, you know, in my mind, but, you know, have beautiful conversations daily with my beautiful wife regularly. You know, we talk, almost daily, speak with clients daily. And, you know, the things that you experience in the last week or two, that I experienced in the last week or two, they become quite topical, you know, whatever mm-hmm. they may be. Somebody just, you know, discovering the idea of infinite banking, somebody who's, you know, practiced it for a minute and fallen off the rails or think they're off the rails. And I wind up feeling like I talk about the noise, I talk about red flags, you know, I encourage the one to get to the basics of what we're doing, and the discovery, self-discovery of this would mean something beneficial to you and your family. So I'm always encouraging going to the basics, foundational works and what have you. But then the life experiences, whatever they may be on a topical basis, you know, as you speak to clients. As an example, you know, I was driving to work one morning this week, and you and I had a conversation, and, you know, I'm interrupting your reading time, apparently, which I really don't mean to do. And it was really about Mises and how Mises had written Human Action. And I believe you're going through the second thorough time and how different it is from the first time you went through it. And just making the connection of how Mises wrote and going back to the genesis of particular thoughts or theories, and then he's bringing it forward.
So I was talking about how in reading Ludwig von Mises's Human Action, the way he addresses what he regards as certain fallacies or problem issues in the history of the development of economic thought is he always ties back a certain error to a particular author.
And he names them.
He names them. And that particular author's methodology. Like, so just one example that comes immediately to mind, there's a guy named Frank Knight, prominent University of Chicago economist, who taught that one could basically ignore time when thinking about production. So he regarded production and consumption as synchronous. And so set time preference aside. Mises goes back to addressing how the core of that problem is a misunderstanding of the application of the idea of an evenly rotating economy, or what's called the imaginary construct of a static economy. And so that's just one example, right? He's discussing how, you know, one issue in economic theory, like the idea that there's synchronicity in production and consumption, can be traced to this particular author's own methodological positions. That's an example of what I was talking about. And Mises does that regularly throughout the book.
And so, I don't know, it's probably a 20-minute drive. And sometimes if the conversation's really good, not just with Mr. Griggs, because it's always very stimulating, I'll take the long way, right? And But it, in the and we had several conversations this week, and that one of in a couple of things that came up in conversation is, you know, who has gone through that work thoroughly. Not very many people, so we're narrowing down the people. Then who goes back and thoroughly goes through it the second time? You know, because it's very dense reading for me, right? Very dense. And so it takes me a long time to go. And some other works came up in reference in the comparison of the density and the writing style of the author. And then invariably or very often, you know, the conversations include interactions with clients or agents or what have you. And I love the way Mises reverts back to the origins and names. I love that, right? Mm-hmm. But that, if not that, very close conversation in relation to the time that we had that, was what kind of is going on in the infinite banking world, where who thoroughly reads Nelson's works and becoming your own banker, how privatized banking really works, and some others. I mean, who really goes through that, and then who really goes back and dissects it, right? And that number of people is very narrowed, mm-hmm. right? And so you go out into the big wide world of marketing within the infinite banking footprint, which, and I think I've shared it, whether they've been released yet or not in previous podcasts, the last few months, clown world keeps coming to my mind, you know, and I don't want to be negative, and I'm not negative. I'm very positive, but the type of clown world marketing, and here's my point, if I can wrap this up. People don't go through at a deep level once, much less twice, a work like Mises. But they oftentimes rely on someone else's interpretation of a work, especially in the infinite banking footprint. You know, we can all go out there and type in infinite banking, bank on yourself or whatever, and have AI produce a book and sell it as a pamphlet, or produce a pamphlet and sell it as a book or what have you. And my point here is that an awful lot of times it seems to me that if I'm convinced of something, right, whether it's in a lot of the times it could be based on someone else's presentation, interpretation, position, and if I accept that, and I choose, we have to choose to accept or reject, right? And if I choose to accept that, my thinking stops typically right then, and they don't continue to think through the process. And then, you know, of course, I speak to my lovely wife every day, right? And we have great conversations, and it doesn't always focus around infinite banking and all that.
Just most of the time.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. or business. Or it's the idea that is that really a good method, a system, a foundation? If I see a good presentation, whatever it is, could be an automobile, could be real estate, what, I don't care what it is. If I hear a good presentation, and even if the presentation is in a book that I've read, right, or from a book that you've read, and you're presenting, and you have conviction, and you're well spoken with clarity and authority, and I choose to accept that, and then I stop thinking. Compared to the maybe Socrates or Aristotle, you know, some of the where if I can't articulate what I believe and why I believe it, as well as being able to articulate the opposing position, then I have a weakened position.
Yeah.
Right. And if I wrap that together, you know, some of the some of the negative comments that we receive from time to time, and I assure you the negative comments are far outweighed by the positive comments, and I appreciate all the positive comments. I don't release negative comments when, I'll talk about them all day long, but I don't release them, you know, whenever they're it seems to me, because there's value. I see that there's value in negative comments, okay? But they also seem to try to promote their own channel or whatever work that they're doing. I don't really see any of them, positive or negative. But they can't articulate, when there is a negative comment, they can't articulate their point, much less do they listen to what is said here to the point where they can articulate what is being said and conveyed. So that's kind of where I didn't even write those notes down that he blasted from talking about what we talked about for an hour before we turned on but that's kind of where my mind is kind of what's going on in the big wide world relative to me and what I experience and have in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. So that's all. So let me say a few things about that. So yeah, on the way up, I listened to episode 223 of this podcast, The Sum is Worse Than Its Parts. And we stressed in that episode the sort of cumulative effect of the various kinds of things that are talked about in the noise, like the anti-base premium philosophy, like the bigger number, sooner, better idea, you know, as high a cash value as early as possible. Oh, one of the big four companies calls one of their policies high early cash value, the HECV. So, you know, that's what we need to do. We'll just drag and drop the life insurance company product name over into the marketing funnel, and that's how we'll sell life insurance. The annually renewing term riders. You had a great point that I thought was I failed to properly highlight about the blended term PUA rider, where they're combined. Like, you can't drop the blended part and keep the PUA part.
You can't redirect the dividend to just go to the PUA, let me pay the term separately.
Right. The bundling sort of puts additional contractual bound. Okay, so, you know, in that episode, we're talking about how all these, you know, we've talked a lot over the last 5 years about each of these things individually. Oh, of course, direct recognition, you know, the problem of incurring a dividend penalty in the event you're actually making use of the policy and keeping policy loan balances outstanding from one policy year to the next. I mean, these things all start to tie together to produce its own unique set of problems because of how they often come bundled. And of course, you know, I get triggered in that. And then we had mentioned comments at the beginning about the prior three-part series we did where I also got pretty hot. And that is true. And along the lines of what you're talking about with, you know, the idea of going back to the source, you know, the term of deep work came to mind, like narrow focus, deep, not exclusive, not like being closed-minded, but just focusing narrowly and going deep on a given idea, like Mises, going back to the origin of a certain idea, going back then to what was behind that idea, right? The mental framework, the methodology that the original proponent of the idea had in mind, like doing that, tracing all the way back to the roots, brings this sort of understanding. In my advisory process, I talk a lot about the development of a very high resolution, very clear image of how things will work. I think doing that, like going back to the source, tracing something to the source, and then tracing the origins of the idea in the originator's own mind to the prior like fundamental assumptions, like that produces an image of understanding that's extremely compelling. It could be revolting, it could be attractive, but either way, it's very powerful. And I think knowing or having a sense of that power sort of primes an individual, certainly primes me emotionally, such that when I see that so viciously neglected, it's
and scandalously promoted. Yeah, my words,
yes,
not his.
It's absolutely triggering. And yeah, I was looking for the papers over here, but I think you've got them over there. But this, you know, someone, one of the unreleased comments, I thought it was funny, and we can own the negative press. So it was, this guy goes 3 weeks ago, some financial services person. Dude, what is the bald guy so amped up about? I think
his hair's a little thin too. I don't know.
Look, I'm not bald. It's shaving. Okay? It's the difference. My gosh, this is unwatchable. I suffered through 15 minutes of it. Well, you know how we feel.
No. Does he know? Did he listen? He's a financial guy anyway. And listen, don't, no disparagement to financial people, but it's been my experience over the last 33 years. Most financial people already know everything. And if you don't believe me, just ask him. So did he listen? No, he could barely suffer through 15 minutes and talk about a long version. Mm-hmm. That was a long version. It was my decision, overriding decision. Ryan loves long form. I do too. But I broke it up in three, right, which is never done. Okay, I like doing things I've never done before too. He could suffer through 15 minutes of, well, I don't even know, the first, second, or third. No, he does not know, in my opinion, what was said, nor does he care to understand, which goes back to my point. If you can't defend your position on whatever topic it is, right, to the point where you can convey with clarity, then you have a weak position. And then if you can't understand the opposing position with clarity and maybe even promote that, right? If you can't argue both sides of whatever the issue is, my position is that you have a weak position.
Yeah.
So
I don't want to drag you too far. This is just mentioned in passing. I'm just saying, like, I'm okay with the fact that it's upsetting to some people that we get that I, in particular, speak for myself, that I do get passionate about things because I do care. And, you know, I've had this past week, I get people who have talked about, you know, their interactions with other agents, or maybe interactions with agents they've worked with in the past, and how these guys disappear. You know, I got one guy in the Northeast, one of those small, very cold states, where he'd been a current client. He works with this group that's well known, pays, you know, reasonable premium, maybe less than his financial situation would suggest is appropriate, but whatever. He's paying premium, and he wanted to go and get policies on his kids, and he couldn't get in touch with the guy who sold the original. So it's like, this is just one example of.
But how often does that occur?
Every week. Maybe one or more times per week. Like, it's a regular occurrence that, I'm not the most well-seen, well-publicized, most visible figure out there. There are other guys who are more visible out there, and that is making noise. Yeah. He's popular. He's a popular person. But so the...
Yeah, I really can't.
We're not the most visible out there, which to some, you know, it kind of is what it is. I don't have time to focus on building the marketing machine. We were at a conference recently with some life insurance company, and, you know, these guys can't help themselves but talk about how proud they are that they're no longer in production. One of my comments to an individual I was speaking with this week is like, you know, you meet these guys, and it's not everybody, right? There are people who, you know, we've mentioned Doug Jones outside of Atlanta, Barry Dyke in the Northeast as well, who they still work one-on-one with individual people and have for decades, right? Like, there are people who do still do that, but many, maybe the majority, certainly the majority of the most visible people online can't escape the client interaction fast enough.
Of course.
And they're sprinting from it. You know, we hear about people, they want to go and buy the book of business of other agents, right? So that they can expand their lead generation machine, because then that feeds the sales force. This one company, I don't want to give like too many details, but life insurance companies in general love the idea of building like rapid issue products, you know, policies that have the bare minimum of underwriting, if any. You know,
they're all moving to that.
And you can fog a mirror and they want to issue the policy type thing. Small policies, very tight sort of prerequisite underwriting requirements. You know, you got to have a nice credit score and all this.
Limited, when you say small policy, limited face amounts.
Yeah.
That really don't fit within the
not appropriate for like a banking type.
Or legitimate capitalism. No.
Yeah.
They don't fit.
But, you know, this one agent at this conference goes, he's like, well, you know, because with these rapid issue type policies, there's typically a more limited range of available underwriting statuses, right? You can't get the super preferred or the preferred. They're commodified. They're like rapid issue, standardized.
Velocity, baby.
Yeah, get them out. Turn them over, right? And so one of the questions from one of the agents at one of these conferences was, well, you know, does the company have a legal concern, you know, if somebody ends up with a policy with this standardized underwriting status and they look back and say, gosh, I should have got preferred or super preferred. You know, is the company worried about litigation after the fact, saying I should have got a better status when the agent stuck me with this rapid issue product?
The agent didn't disclose any of that in the beginning anyway.
Well, the agent goes, I don't know. And you weren't there because I was in shock.
I didn't attend that meeting.
The guy goes, you know, some of our people just click one of the buttons in the software. They might click the rapid issue one and not the conventional one and just may not know. Like, sorry. And I'm like, at the therapy, writing my notes to myself, I'm like, under no circumstances, none, zero circumstances, is it even within the realm of possibility that one should be mixing up accidentally a rapid issue, standardized, limited product with a conventional, traditional type of, how could that even happen? Like, oh, our sales force just mixed it up. I mean, listen, how did your sales force get to work in the morning? I mean, did they follow the traffic signs or like?
Wait, there's a whole lot there. As fat as my fingers are, and as non-tech as I am, if I accidentally press the wrong button, right? How could you, exactly what you're saying, how could you possibly have any kind of understanding or relationship, however minimal that may be or be perceived, with a client to press the wrong button, and now you're going to have an inferior product because of my fat finger.
Right.
It's like, my point being, there is no, it's churn and burn, baby.
Yeah.
It's get them in, get them out, get them in, velocity, period.
So notice the contrast, right? That is the superficiality of what's out there as contrasted with this very deep kind of work. So on the other side of it, on the deep side, I was a client, Zach, you know who you are, you watch, thank you, sent me a video of a different office defending the value of a modified endowment contract. And that's not the point. They had a particular argument for it, and that's not the point. But the individual who is being interviewed regarding the potential usefulness of modified endowment contracts kept referring to this accumulation and decumulation, I would use the word distribution, but you know, the phases of your financial life or the phases of your financial development. And the assumed authority, this gets to what you were talking about, where we just kind of stop thinking, where we accept initial assumptions or we accept certain preconceptions, we accept certain basic fundamental
starting
points.
That's the problem. And my
exactly.
vision.
Well, this is why I asked you about this before we started recording. It's like this, you know, when I worked for a big four company for all of 2 weeks, which is all I could handle, that's all they could handle of me, rather.
You're a better employee than I am.
Yeah, I know. What did I know? Nothing. I'm fresh out of college. So what do you know? Less than nothing. But the key framework, the sort of intellectual infrastructure that framed or structured the sales process, right? That sales construct within which you could promote certain products, was the idea of protection, accumulation, distribution. This three phases of the financial life cycle type approach. And I just noticed in this interview, like, wow, we're just taking that one for granted. Which, and look, there may be something to it, there may not be, but that is a distinct construct, protection, accumulation, distribution. And so I was in thinking of what I wanted to talk about today for this episode ahead of time. I had written that down. I was just reflecting on it. And some of its shortcomings, things that I might criticize. The first of which was and this is very common with economists, a conflation or a confusion, grouping the two ideas together inappropriately with money and value, right? It's the idea that what's accumulated, when we think of accumulate, you accumulate stuff in your pantry, you accumulate clothes in your closet, you accumulate stuff, things. And people often refer to their portfolio or however they regard their financial assets as their money, right? I've got, my money is with so-and-so. My money is in this or that. And that's metaphorical talk, right? Like, we're not stacking up Federal Reserve notes or digits on a screen in a checking account on the expectation that in some amount of decades we're then going to withdraw them, take them out and go do something, spend them somewhere else. That's not what's happening. The accumulation is the accumulation of particular kinds of property. It's going out and buying stuff. Right? There's no money there. Right? The idea is that the property is worth something under certain terms. It's always prospective, right? Value's in the mind. Right? It's not in the property. It's not in the account. Brother.
I'm looking at my money on this statement. It's like Social Security trust fund.
Yeah.
They're accumulating.
Well, you showed me an email from somebody who was maybe having some difficulty understanding of some of the things that you had went through in your process, kept referring to the balance in the policy. People get mad at me because I'm too critical about
the use of specific words. Hey, don't judge me by my clients, because by any one client.
No,
you can judge me by my clients because they're beautiful, they're understandable. There'll be 100 or so accumulated later this year in one place at the client event, and they're beautiful people.
No, my point is, you can tell by the words people use whether they're tracking with what you've been saying or not, right? The reference, the common ones, like treating a policy as an account, having a cash value balance, or the conflation of conventional financial terms over into the life. And that's the only part that I meant about that is, and where was I going with that?
Sorry, I hate to interrupt, but man, I have great points that I pass over because you're delivering great points. So I'll stop.
Well, the more fundamental thing here was the idea of protection, accumulation, distribution. The acceptance of these three phases that there is such a thing as whatever they might call it, your financial journey, your financial plan, and that it's split up into phases, and that that's what these phases are. That's what it was, the money and value thing. Right, we're conflating those two things, and that can matter, right? Because if we're not stocking up money per se, if instead we're acquiring property, well, that raises the question, well, which kinds of property? And how might we evaluate the propriety, the worthiness, the efficacy of different types of property, just basic categories, real estate, financial assets, insurance. Like, you open up a new range of potential questions if you get rid of that oversimplified caricature, that metaphorical caricature of, I've got my money over there, right? That's what I was getting to. So that's one. Another one. It's limited to one person's lifetime. Protection, accumulation, distribution. It's so typically American, right? It's you, just the one person, your life, right? And then, of course, there's this idea just in conventional life insurance planning of, I'm not leaving any money to my kids. They're going to go make it themselves. I had to make it myself, so they're going to make it themselves. I'm not helping anybody. I made it. It's mine. I can't take it with me. I'm going to enjoy it. And there are people in my family who have that idea, right? This sort of, and look, on its own, if that wasn't so bitter and hostile to future generations, maybe you could understand it, right? But there's always that extra bit of condescension towards the future people of, for the penalty, for the crime of having not existed yet, right? that's so weird, right? And even in one's own life, wouldn't it be cool, if we could go back and change the past, wouldn't it be nice, if the people who came before us did more for us? And by the way, didn't they? Didn't prior generations leave us with all of this, productive capacity, all these, the real estate, the infrastructure that already exists, the computers, the technology we already have. I mean, those were, We're expressing our hostility towards leaving things for the future generation on material that were left for us by previous generations. I mean, there's almost a hypocrisy to it.
I have
right?
a beautiful ballpoint pen.
Yeah, right.
I'm just saying.
Well, all these things were left for us by people who came prior. It's like, so where's the honor in like stopping that process? That ethos, that idea that it's yours to protect, to accumulate, and then to distribute to who? Yourself, is so self-centered and so arbitrarily limited in time frame, right? It's the opposite of thinking however many generations into the future.
America. But yeah, yeah. Keep going.
Criticisms like these that are not immediately obvious. Oh, the three phases. I can be the clever financial advisor, and I've got my three phases that I read about in my book from a marketing organization. It's like,
They train.
Can we trace this to like its original? And I tried looking. It's like it's difficult to find like where that basic construct came about. I did come across the name Lauren Dunton, D-U-N-T-O-N, Lauren, L-O-R-E-N, Lauren Dunton, a salesman who was the instigator behind the creation of a lot of these financial organizations, like the Certified Financial Planners Board. And a lot of these, it's very similar to human life value in life insurance, right? The idea that you have a maximum insurability, you know, that death benefit is indemnification for loss. What your people are losing is the present value of your future income, right? A rough approximation of that is your current annual gross income multiplied by a number of years into the future. The younger you are, the greater the number of years that there are of future income generation. Because what your people lose when you go is your income that you would ostensibly earn each year for a period of years into the future. And so the product of that is your maximum insurability, right? And that should control or regulate how much in death benefit you can buy. That idea, which is a regulatory idea today, right? It does limit how much death benefit you can get. That started as a marketing tactic, right? It was this is in the 20s, right? The technocratic area where everyone's getting real scientific, right? This sort of startup of Soviet Union, Soviet era type central planning. We want to give everybody some precious, precious numbers that they can wrap their minds around and base their life around. So this is a very technocratic approach to structuring a sales process, right? And that became over time a regulatory cap, right? So again, this idea of tying back contemporary ideas to their origins. And so I tried to do that with this protection, accumulation, distribution idea and just came across this Lauren Dunton thing. And, you know, a lot of the ideas you find circulating in what I call conventional finance that is sort of not self-aware of itself are traceable to just decades-old marketing tactics, right? Like
the marketing tactics... That being one, there are several that exist prominently. Then they create the curriculum for you to learn these marketing tactics.
Yes.
Right. And either the company pays them or adopts them or creates their own. The creation and the adoption of all that accumulated. And then now you, financial wannabe advisor agent here, you come learn this, and if you pass all our exams, we'll give you a designation if you pay us regularly.
Right, yeah, regularly. Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Yes, there's a structure to all of that.
They're not disconnected.
Yeah. I do contrast it. People say, well, it's just what IBC is. I have to stress that when Nelson published this book, he got out of the business. I don't think that is this wasn't his sales tool,
that wasn't his sales,
right? To go trip around
funnel, the tripwire.
I love this, you know, page 3, the first page in the introduction. Becoming your own banker, the infinite banking concept is a text for a 10-hour course of instruction about the power of dividend paying whole life insurance. It is not a sales tool for life insurance agents. It is education that the life insurance industry should have taught during the last 200 years. Right? So it's not a sale. And look, people could say, again, you go back to the semantics and say, well, it's all the same. You know, it's all a way to say. And the life insurance companies do not help anybody, right? Because they regard IBC as a sales system.
To this day, yeah. The companies that you probably own.
And they're proud of it. It's so obnoxious, right? They're proud. Sales system.
Their defense, you know, is like, well, you know, don't use the word banking and be the, you know, bring more regulatory scrutiny upon ourselves. But then yet they do that. They
feed it. Yeah, they feed it.
Yeah, yeah. But then they personally turn around and they pay high premium. And let me bring some granularity to that. These are individuals, and I don't know everyone in the insurance industry, and by God, I don't want to, okay? By golly. So these are people that have been in the industry a very long time. I'm talking 20, 25, 30, 35 years. They didn't begin paying high premium cash value life insurance until they read this book, right? Which most of them won't read in the home offices in general. I mean, just think about that, okay?
Yeah.
So, and then, yeah, it's a sales tactic. It's a sales tool. It's a like all the rest of them, so, you know, LEAP, there's
bank
tons
on,
of
yeah,
them.
There's bank on yourself.
Yeah, family this, family that, my new this, my new that.
Family.
Yeah, your family, my family, our family.
Yeah. Buzzwords. Hey, let's just ask the AI what the right SEO slogans are. And that's what it is. Whatever that is, that's what this is.
You know, you joke. I mean, you, the listener, go ahead and type infinite banking concepts, you know, explain infinite banking concept in briefly. And then you compare that output to some of these free downloads that are, if you search in the infinite banking world anywhere, that you're constantly bombarded with. Oh, download this free book. Here you can read the first chapter of my book. And just do a comparison. Yeah, granted, they might have gone in there and changed some words. But it's like, what is that, right? Okay, I want to back up too, and I want to back way up because you mentioned a few things, you know, where the part three thing that the podcast that I divided up into three episodes where Mr. Griggs saying he's getting hot and he did mention the word passion. It's like, if you can't distinguish righteous anger, my words, not his, or emotional passion. I'm being redundant, right? I mean, passion from individual anger, like I'm going to beat you up personally. It's like, God bless you. Okay. I find the people that in the financial world, which there are a lot of agents and advisors listening to us, and I'll say you're welcome, number one. I'm going to be so bold as to say that. And then I'll follow that up with thank you for listening. All right. There's a lot here that you can't go get elsewhere. There's a lot elsewhere that you're not going to get here, granted. It seems to me the ones that are angry and have the idea or the desire, the need to take time out of their busy life to comment on something that they don't like and can't argue against substantially, you know, it just, those are the ones that have the negative commentary.
Yeah.
Right. They don't. So.
Which is fine. Keep it going.
Yeah. Thank you, too.
Thanks for the engagement.
You know, I did an hour and a half of Q&As yesterday recording.
Bless your heart.
I know. And there's still a kind of a lot more to do. But a couple of emails that are, I'm just going to dissect, you know, point by point by point. And they're, of course, they're coming from a negative aspect. And at first, it's like, oh, you know, dang. You know, I at one time when I was a younger man, I might have got angry. Today, I don't get angry. I'm like, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to try to rebut what is said on this podcast, right? And so thank you. I mean, I personally believe it's going to be a fail. You know, it's like, let's go to a comedy club and let me heckle the guy with the mic.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. passion and anger. I'm not saying you can't be, you know, have a lot of passion when you're angry, and but I think you should be able to distinguish between.
Sure. Well, I think for a financial person, like, I don't know, maybe it's just me, my personal makeup, personality, disposition, whatever, or the economic background, whatever it is, you know, traumatic childhood, whatever.
The combination of all, right.
Whatever it is that makes me the way I am. I don't know how you can be in financial services and not have an edge, like, and not be kind of ticked off some of the time, because it's like, this, we're dealing with a serious subject and there's a lot of things that are technically wrong that should be provocative. And, you know, I get it. I've got as much spiritual homework to do as anybody to be more, you know, kumbaya graceful. You know, this is an improvement. You're seeing an improved version. Okay, this, it used to be even worse. So, but I don't know how you can't have a little chip on your shoulder. I mean, this should be triggering. It should be triggering. I think it should be triggering a lot of the time.
And then
you're dealing with people's money, but you're also dealing with people's thought processes about their money. And that is, like, in a sense, even more important.
Will have an outcome.
Yeah.
Their actions, right, which is based on their understanding or their decisions, will have an outcome. And, okay, so if I, let's say I got licensed, you know, 2 years ago, and I got a lot of clients and I'm knocking it out of the park, I'm doing really good. I have no idea what the outcome is going to be. And I have I may have an idea of what the outcome is going to be, but I don't have the experience to have maybe a greater understanding, however you want to convey that. 33 years later, it's like, oh, the outcome is maybe not what you thought it was going to be. And so I'm just saying it makes a difference. But, too, you know, Ryan sat down going back, you know, hour and a half driving down here. What do you want to talk about? He posed that question on the accumulation, protection accumulation and distribution. He asked me the origin. And so here I'm thinking back and I couldn't trace it to an origin, but I could trace it to, in my mind, a time period right through my experience. Before I continue on that, I want to say then, even before that, he mentioned the word high resolution on some of these things. The hour that I'm talking about, and don't worry, we'll make it available some way, somehow, sometime in the future. I don't know. But the hour conversation that we had before we, started this episode was very high resolution on very high value ideas that we both have. And I'm so excited about them. All right. Now, I know I'm backing up and doing an overview. I just want to, you know, keep you up to speed. Okay. All right. So.
Well, part of this goes with this. Because I know. And talking about, you know, these three phases thing, we've mentioned the difference between money and value. You know, so what is accumulated during the accumulation phase? It's not money. It's property. And then what is distributed at the distribution phase? It's not the property that's distributed, it's money. Right, okay, so we've got to do something with the property, which raises the question, what are you going to do? You know, does that mean sell it? Does that mean transfer ownership of it? Does that mean borrow against it? What's that look like?
Liquidate it.
Right. So, again, raises new question. When you drop the unhelpful metaphor, it raises new, more nuanced questions that can be helpful in developing a strategy. And where my mind goes with this, I've mentioned this briefly, but one thing that we did talk about in that hour before the cameras turned on is how little we've fleshed this out further, and I think it's something that we will do more of, is the role of a private family foundation in both the distribution, both providing for one's own late life needs, but then also in the establishment of both a financial and intellectual legacy. And that's been, you know, again, this is a prime example of the cost of dwelling too much on the noise, is neglecting things like this that are of much greater value, that are much more neglected, that other people just aren't going to deal with. I've had an occasion with a few clients who, you know, true believers, true fans, whatever you want to call it, people who have really implemented IBC, you know, they're, if not completely maximally insured.
See, I don't think we talk about those clients enough.
We don't. I had an email. This just raises to my email from a current client. His name, we'll call him Jay. So,
You, Bob.
He knows who he is. But, you know, he's talking about, this is just unsolicited because I don't have a sales structure for the current clients, right? I don't have these scheduled meetings where I can like evaluate your finances to find some money to sell you more products because I don't do that. But we have a, you know, it's a much more, it's a relationship, client advisor relationship. And I make a point to talk about service after the fact. Like this is, if you get a policy through my office, that in my mind creates a client advisor relationship. And so we have ongoing access. Like we can talk and some people want that, other people don't. And anyway, this individual, Jay, just sent me an email and said, I love this. For the next, I'm paraphrasing, I want more base for these next ones. Our first two were of a 30-70 type structure. I want to have more base. I want to have more base, more base. I'd also like to explore convertible term policies to cover as much of our remaining insurability as possible. Don't really have a good sense of where that puts us in death benefit, so some insights here would be helpful to see how that plays out with respect to the convertible term policies.
That doesn't bring a tear to your eye.
Yeah.
I don't know what will.
Oh, and I'd like to understand what policies on my son, who brand new son basically, would look like given the above.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I mean, how cool! I mean, that you want to talk about like what a true, what someone who gets IBC, who is like full on implementation. That's what that looks like.
Yeah, right? And that's going to have a particular result, and that particular result. Sure, will I be here? It sounds like he's a young guy. If he's just having babies, you know, probably not. Hopefully, that result compared to the other short sighted results, where because I was, you know, mesmerized by something flashy and shiny and convincing and what have you, it'll have a result too. And the comparison between the two results are going to be dramatically different, right? Okay. And so, yeah, not only do we, that was only one thing, one topic of what we really did in the first hour before we kind of prioritized some of the.
Oh, I got more. I got more.
Oh, I'm sure you do. I said we kind of prioritized some of the things that we'd like to do, the works that we'd like to complete, you know, individually, jointly, and then kind of put a time preference on them, mm-hmm. it, you know, through value. But so there was more than just a family, the private family foundation. There's some really good things.
But four clients like that, the true believer types I've talked with, we've started to have these conversations around like, okay, what's this look like? Genuinely long, like super long term, like what's the full extension of this look like? Because look, at some point you're gonna go, right? We're gonna go, death benefit's gonna get paid. Where's that money gonna go, right? How's it gonna take care of your people who are already alive now, but then also their people into the future, right? Like how do you create like a permanent, systematic, ongoing,
stable
that can last in perpetuity?
Yeah. And it really gets down to the thinking. See, his thinking, what?
That's much more exciting.
Of course it is. And then the interactions with those types of clients compared to the one that tries not to get it, right? Because are they listening? Are they listening to the over 500 hours or video? I don't know how many hours. Are they listening? Yeah, I get it's long form. I get it. It's nuanced. And, you know, you hear the comments like, you know, we can talk, beat something up, beat an idea up, talk about Mises. I mean, And I get it. We all have limited time, no question. But if I'm going to put $10,000, $5,000, $1 million, whatever the number is, it's relative to you. You know, $500,000 to you may be, oh my gosh. Well, that could be chump change to someone else where $500 a month could be, you know, mm-hmm. So it's relative. But if you're going to put a substantial amount of your money in, that you've exchanged your time to earn, and that time exchange, you've given up time with your family or what are all of these other wonderful things you want to do, and then you're committing a future amount of production to continue the capitalization phase of anything on the life insurance policy, since we're talking about the infinite banking concept. and you will forego the thought process because you latched on or you were taken off the beaten path by a shiny object and looking at short term. And it's about time thinking. You're just shortchanging yourself. You're not shortchanging the agent or the advisor who's going to make less commission or do whatever. And not only are you shortchanging yourself, you're shortchanging your people and the things that you really love and value. And okay, I don't want to get too far off the beaten path. I've said it and I still say it. Well, everybody wants to focus on 1 year, 2 years, the next deal, the next raise, the next bonus, the next purchase, the next whatever. And, well, what does that look like in 50 years? Oh, James, you're going to talk to me about 30 years from now. I'm 20, 25, 30 years old. You want to talk to me about 20, 25, 30 years from now? Yes. Yes, absolutely I do. Now, does that mean you're going to have to burn everything down and you won't be able to do the things that you want to do, the things that your wife or your spouse wants you to do, the things that you enjoy? No, we're not sacrificing any of that. And then, oh, wait, if we can only think in 30 years, if your statistical life expectancy is, say, 30 years. If you can't think beyond 30 years, why should you? Oh, I don't know. How old is your youngest child? Right? Let's say they're 3 years old. You tell me how quick that last 3 years went. And the next three, you're going to go faster. Okay. And, oh, wait, they're going to grow up and do exactly what you've done, right? Or maybe they're going to do the exact opposite of what you've done because you have fallen. I don't know. But they're going to have children. Oh, wait. Now can we talk about 50-year timelines? Why can't we? My point is, why can't we talk about 50-year timelines?
And the idea, because this is what, and I know part of that short-term minded, oh, why would I leave anything for anybody? I made it, I'll spend it type attitude, is the assumption, the flawed misconception that long-term future-oriented planning somehow requires sacrifice, right? I've got to hurt myself now in order to be better off in the future. When in fact, an articulated, clear picture of the very long term, and maybe even the structure that supports that long-term plan, articulation of that can bring motivation and encouragement and direction and clarity and integration to what you're doing today, right? It puts structure. You know, Jordan Peterson, who Nelson liked, you know, talking about the boundary between order and chaos, right? Anxiety is the feeling of chaos, of lack of order, of disorientation or non-orientation. A long-term, for as long as possible type strategy, not even the plan. I don't like the plan. The plan's like the output of the strategy. You know, the strategic emphasis, the structure of the strategy can bring coherence. And again, it's regarding the future. So it's abstract, but conceptual, structured coherence to what was previously chaotic, right? And that is to me, I don't know about you, that to me is extremely motivating. It's like, oh my God, this is where all of this goes. Like, this is how it's going to fit together. You know, I'm not just meeting my and my family's needs for today or tomorrow or next week or this year. No, I'm doing all those things, but I'm also doing it in a way that serves for us in the very long term, right? That should be, that's compelling. I don't care who you are. That's compelling.
I marked the time down. We're about 52 minutes into that because when you say structure, and I and everyone hears everybody, when I say structure, I understand it's very broad. And I understand the language in the infinite banking footprint that's quickly is turning into, continues to turn into a clown world. You know, not my tent, not my monkeys, right? I want no association with the majority of things that go on within the infinite banking footprint. Okay, I'm just speaking that very clearly. I know that the properly structured is very broad. I understand that specifically structured, specially designed, all of this terminology that's very broad and unclear unless you download the clickbait or the AI written book or the ghost written book, and they'll share with you their opinion of what specially designed means. Okay. So, and James, you're saying the same thing. No, I'm not. I know I'm speaking very broadly when I say properly designed, you know, a proper structure. What does that mean to you? Where you're at, where you are going, what your timeline is, and that's individualistic, period. So it can't necessarily be the same structure. You mentioned 70-30 with your one client. Now he wants to have a higher price. That's with one particular company. A 70-30 might be appropriate for that individual at that time, at his level of understanding. With another company, a completely different products could require a different structure for the same timeline. I want to be very clear here and wrap it up. All in love. It's properly structured is individual to you. And if you don't have the relationship, the advisory relationship that Ryan refers to over and over and over, if your people, your office, your agent, your advisor doesn't understand you to the point in your situation and have the experience and knowledge, right, to deliver something that will support what you want now and in the future, all of that dictates the structure. Mm-hmm. Right? I can't, you know, and look, there's a lot of video out there, you know, I said 500 hours, whatever, 500 total, whatever. I've done the presentations over and over and over at real estate groups. They still live out there on the internet. I showed how I financed a truck with my wife's policy. I showed a real estate investor whom had short-term thinking, and how much of that did I cater to? Probably, I will take my responsibility of blame, right? I get it. Those videos are old. And so many different things have changed within the life insurance industry, within the tax code, you know, the 7702 changes. And they've changed since those videos have been out. They changed between those videos and what Nelson did in 2000 and what he did in 1959. You know, so it's relative to as well in what can be done with a company and their products and in the design of their products. My point here being is, one of the points I want to make is, I get it. You love Excel spreadsheets. I get it. You cannot put a life insurance policy on an Excel spreadsheet. I have zero interest in building illustrations to prove my point. Right. And why? The illustration, when I say it's wrong when you press print, it's not because that's a great, you know, off the cuff, cheeky, pithy saying. It's in fact true. Yeah. The dividend goes up or down. You go up or down in premium. Any variation from that illustration is going to change the outcome. So
I get the frustration with people, you know, just show me the numbers. It's such a, you know, people are eyeballs deep in a materialist, technocratic culture and scientific, philosophical paradigm that they can't even see straight. I get it. And then we raise these objections and it sounds like begging the question. It's like, okay, I get all the caveats, but still, let me see. Here's becoming your own banker. Here's an illustration that you could go look at. You know, I wonder if the people who, here's two more. That's just part four of equipment. Oh, here's another one you could go look at. You know, here's another one. Right. Book's been out since 2000. There are examples out there. There are illustrations out there. There's no shortage of illustrations out there. There's also no shortage. There's an abundance of misguided and misleading illustrations out there. If people spent as much time looking at just the illustrations in this book and dissecting line by line the values that appear in those columns, if they spent as much time doing that as they do complaining about the lack of illustrations on the internet, we wouldn't have as much tension around the subject as we do. Right, the illustrations are there, and people say, "Well, I just want to see the document, see the number." Okay, they're there. Right, you can go look at them, and yeah, I get it. It's not your numbers, right? But the numbers on the page aren't your for an illustration aren't your numbers either, right? Other than your age and the initial face amount. I mean, everything else is just assumptions about what may or may not happen in the future, right? And all of that's got to be talked about conceptually. So that it's an excuse. Let's just be real flat about it. It's an excuse, right? To say, I don't have the numbers, show me the numbers. That is an excuse to not accept the responsibility to go do the deep conceptual work that's required to understand a whole life policy, because the numbers are there, right? And the questions that I get or what I see are not, hey, I don't understand line 10 on page 56 or whatever it may be. It's, I want to see the numbers. It's like, well, if that desire to get neck deep in the numbers were so visceral and overwhelming, then one would think that you might already be in the numbers that are out there, and then raising questions about those before adding on to the misunderstanding and the misconceptions that are already there with even more of the same.
I agree.
Right, that is how you get lost in the noise, right? This admonition to go to the source is not just like some cute slogan. It's like, no, the necessary foundation is there. And if there are other concerns pertaining to the concept, one must go to the origin of that concept. You must go to the foundation and study those. And if they don't make sense, well, then great. That is great material to work through with me or with James or with, you know, somebody, whoever it is you're working with, right? Talk through what's there, because this is material from the source, right? You don't have to take anybody's word for it as to where it came from, right? There's not even the possibility here that this could be being used to mislead you in some way, because it was written 24 years ago, right?
Man,
that is how you disabuse the situation. It's how you eliminate from the situation all of this tension and hostility around the use and manipulation of numbers. Right? It's just get out of that whole framework. Get out of that whole context. Swipe left. Right? Go back to the foundation. And then once you're steeped in that foundation, then if you know you have a petulant for masochism, you can go and indulge yourself with all of the different approaches for what is the quote-unquote right policy designed for everybody at all times and all places that you'll find online.
I'm going to have to break out a dictionary and just have it on hand for my peeps sometimes. Listen, I thank you for sharing that. I have a couple of comments that I just can't restrain. Number one, Nelson said many times, and granted, you know, you referenced the 10-hour seminar in the beginning. From Nelson's page 3.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing available today is 6.5 hours because other people decided what should not be included in the 10 hours. All right, now I've had my chops busted for, James, you keep mentioning 10 hour, 6.5. I had no say in what was taken out of that 10-hour seminar. I did have the pleasure of listening to it delivered personally over 30 times in my life.
And you've got to have, there has to be a recording. That you've
I'm not saying I don't have or two or three recordings may not exist. I'm not saying that, but they don't exist at NNI. Okay, and we're deep enough into it. All the haters, they don't listen. Listen, Nelson said many times, and I'm sure it's on recording somewhere. If he were to republish or if he had it to do over again, becoming your own banker, he would not have an illustration in the book. He would not republish the book with illustrations again, because it serves as a point of confusion, not only to the general reader who wants to get up and learn all about life insurance, the client that wants to beat the agent up about numbers on a page and a spreadsheet and an Excel, man, have all that you want. It's a point of confusion to the agent. Okay, and if you think everybody in the life insurance industry can spit out an illustration from the life insurance company's software that they've mastered, and some are very good, and once you've mastered that, then you can also manipulate it, right? And I'm not saying everybody out in the big wide world is nefarious. I'm not saying that. Nelson himself said he would not include an illustration if he were to rewrite Becoming Your Own Banker. But since they're there, equipment financing, page 54, the first illustration. This, I believe, talking about Mises, how he goes back into the origins of the methodological the method that a particular author had expressed, and Mises thought there might have been error, and he thought he might could bring clarity to it, reaches back to that, and then names names. I love that. Okay. I'm just reaching back. All right. Little old James Nethery. Here we are in 2024. The book was published in 2020. That's a Guardian illustration. They're not all Guardian illustrations in the book. And just because Nelson used a Guardian illustration doesn't mean Guardian is the only company or the company that would serve you the best. Not disparaging Guardian whatsoever. Illustration number one, Nelson Nash paid a premium out of pocket, or illustrated a premium being paid out of pocket for 4 years. And if you look at the third column from the left, that's the last year that he illustrated a premium. And you go right over to the third column from the right, $40,000 a year for 4 years is $160,000. He even highlights this for you. Okay. And then he highlights $157,000 in cash value. On the non-guaranteed side of the ledger, might I add. Okay. And so within the Infinite Banking footprint, and it has been so from my whole experience, I attended the third think tank that Nelson hosted, and I've generally not missed one since. Maybe I have missed one since. I don't know everything. I haven't been everywhere. I have met a lot of agents and a lot of advisors, and many of them through Nelson's think tank. And I've spoken to many of them, just like Mr. Griggs has spoken to many of them. My point here is this. Nelson demonstrated $160,000 in total premium being paid in the first 4 years, $40,000 a year. Highlights $157,000 in cash value, third column from the right, on the non-guaranteed side of the ledger. And so this has served as a point of confusion from day one to the agent that has attended all of these think tanks. The goal being, in their mind, is to go cash on cash in the fourth year. Tell me I'm wrong. Go out there and look at all the presentations out there and the ones that you experience with your agent. It's like, oh, how soon can I go cash on cash? Look, you get it done over here in 5 years on the guarantee side, 4 years on the non-guarantee side, whatever, whatever. Nelson didn't build this policy to do that. Right? And the fact is you can't do that today. And I've talked about this at length and in depth many times. Have it recorded. The changes, what he did, the structure, right? The changes in the 7702 code, the changes in the CSO tables, the commissioner standard ordinary tables. All of that dictates how policies are constructed by insurance companies. So the mere fact that the goal is to be cash on cash as soon as possible is a fallacy. Short-term thinking. I want a shortcut. There are no shortcuts. Well, this is what Nelson did. He did that in 2020. This is 2024. So that was an appropriate structure for Nelson's nephew at that time. Okay? This is 24 years later, and you're not Nelson's nephew, and neither am I. And then I've got my finger on page 38, the table, the scale that Nelson used. Read that. Go back and please reread. Read it five times. Read it as many times as it takes to understand what Nelson is saying. Page 38, single premium all the way down to term. Where's the mech line snuggling up to the mech line? And he tells you how to build a banking policy. And if your policy doesn't line up with that philosophy, then you could have done better than what you've done. And I'm not blaming you. I'm just saying. And then in addition to that, Nelson said many times, I know it's on recording, the most important part of this book. Page 28, part two, the human problems. This is where most people are and where most people fail. And I mean, I'm talking about me, myself, I'm including myself. This is the flawed thinking right here. You overcome the human problems and all of this other stuff almost doesn't matter. Yeah. You can take these illustrations out of this book and just read the book. And you'll probably do yourself a favor because you'll understand the concept, right? The message that Nelson is delivering, yeah. Controlling the banking function. And then he gives you examples. Oh, my gosh, the oldest thing in the dang life insurance industry is griping about illustrations and then griping about dividend. Well, who pays the highest dividend? Are you going to make a decision based on one point? How old is the company? I mean, oh, my gosh. One time ever.
Yeah. The underlying issue I see with all of these debates that typically generate more heat than light is the lack of a intellectual structure to frame the whole analysis, right? We get hung up, and different people get hung up on different things because for whatever reason it appeals to them, right? The dividend scale.
So the noise appeals to me, getting hung up on the noise and bam, 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 that appeals to me.
Well, that potentially might that. Also be due to the lack of its own structure in a different sense.
Oh, yeah, I know. Rub it in. Yeah. Let me get you some salt.
What we were talking about beforehand, yeah.
I understand. And point taken, and I agree.
Yeah. So everybody has their own particular thing that they get hung up on, right? And it's because of just the peculiarities, right? Whatever seems to matter, maybe your own experience, somebody else's experience you know about, you know, whoever the particular person you're interacting with, who they happen to know, whatever it is. So dividend scales, or some people really care about recognition, you know, direct or non-direct recognition. Some people really care about whether you can recognize the brand name, different things, right? And it's all... This is what I've talked about in the past with like one of the big successes of Wall Street is to just compress and squeeze out all of the vibrancy and nuance of more conceptual thinking about finances. It's, you know, just look where the bigger number is.
Or I just love that. Don't jump over that. To compress and squeeze out all of the nuance.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. To make you fit a more assembly line, standardized, high volume sales process.
Easy right? to sell, so I can train my agents.
Yeah, Henry Ford, oh, you can have any color you want as long as it's black, right? It's just, as long as it's the same, it's great, right? So it's gotta be one size fits all because all that nuance is friction, and friction adds cost to the sales process, and that looks bad for the month end or quarter end, and you know we need to generate these returns so that we can go borrow more money and then collateralize that debt and sell it off overseas and then buy it back and repackage it and, you know, eventually apply for a government program. I mean, this is...
They can bankrupt and we own the law firm that takes them through bankruptcy and then we can buy them privately yeah. with private equity. And then we can leverage the assets again and go public, right? And we get paid every step of the way and then they can go bankrupt again.
Yeah. So the state of the individual financial advisory relationship is reflective of the broader macroeconomic turmoil we have, right? And it all goes hand in hand. You know, I get a kick out of, like, I think it was Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, everybody kind of is familiar with that name. There's this Twitter, like the Pelosi stock tracker thing on Twitter. Yeah. So they'll cover other politicians now occasionally.
Mm-hmm. I got to get back on Twitter, I guess.
And Marjorie Taylor Greene, oh, she's got these very strong cultural values, which great, you may disagree, you may not, bought this big old position in Lululemon. Mm-hmm. I'm like, go look up the cultural attitudes of the CEO of Lululemon. And tell me how much that lines up with Marjorie Taylor Greene. Mm-hmm. It's like if what you could hear when people make their political proclamations is what their stock portfolio consists of, you might get a lot more closer to the real underlying truth of the matter, right? There's so much like propositioning and just verbal vomit out there. Rhetoric is what it is. Rhetoric to get you to think one way or the other. But if you looked under the hood, I've talked about this before, you would realize that pretty much everybody, from the perspective of their financial portfolio, looks and thinks the same, right? They own the same thing, except for the elite. Right, because the elite don't own what they sell you. They own products from life insurance companies, right, to provide for their nice level pension. And
they own life insurance companies and control life insurance companies. And then take them overseas where the regulation is a little bit, I don't want to say non-existent, so I'll say sparse. And then they leverage the fire out of those. That. Oh, my gosh.
So I laugh because it's so perverse. But it, you know, if you look behind the scenes at these things, it's so revealing. It's like, wow. I mean, all of that rhetoric is just performance. Performance art, right? It's
performance art rhetoric. Yeah,
it's creating a public identity to have like the sort of avatar presence to have a following and whatever, to really, at the end of the day, go feed this totally different looking underlying financial picture. And then we'll talk about, you know, protection, accumulation, and distribution. Look at what they're actually accumulating rather than what they're saying.
I'm glad you're bringing that back around, you know, because here we have this beautiful conversation. It'll someday live and it'll come alive, right? Someday. And that was even part of the conversation. You know, we're talking and Ryan's like, no, like, you know, we talk about these things all the time and then they don't come to fruition. So I'm dropping the ball, letting him down, which I don't want to do that. Right. But then we're all limited in time. So the question after that fabulous conversation, that it's almost like bait and switch. I get it. I'm not trying to put a carrot out there for y'all. It was very beneficial for me to kind of prioritize some activities that when they do come to fruition, they will live in perpetuity. Okay, I'll just leave it at that. The question was, hey, he asked if I knew the origin of that protection, accumulation, and distribution. And I said, no, he traced it down to one guy that was creating a sales, you know, product or system for the financial world. And I said, it was my experience, because it's been in the financial world as far as I can remember, you know, going back 33 years. And there's always a sales concept, right? There has to be a new sales concept because we need more assets under management, or we got to have more policies delivered, whatever the case may be. That idea of protection accumulation, or the accumulation distribution, right? The peak of, or applied to a life, you know, when you're young, you're accumulating, the idea that you're going to put something away for the future, and then in the future you're going to take this income, passive income distribution, in quote unquote your retirement years. That, and then he's talking about, well, what's the theory behind that, asking what's the theory behind that. And I'm thinking, no, I agree, there is no theory. That is a sales concept, right, that's easily conveyed to the consumer. So it's really kind of like a method or structural foundation of thinking, mm-hmm. right? and then I just shared that it seems to me somewhere along about 2000, in my experience, 2003 to maybe 2008, that it was really prominent in the life insurance industry. when equity indexed annuities came out, and then they had the income riders that were available to be put upon them, mm-hmm. where you can take the income's going to grow, the income value's going to grow regardless of what the actual account value does. So you have this income that you can't outlive. And I think whatever year that, you know, 12 or 11,000 baby boomers were turning age 65, it was somewhere around there. It became very prevalent. And so I'm glad you brought that back up. But here, I want to make a point that, because I asked him, I'm like, where did you get that? Where are you pulling that from? Because every IMO and agency out there has got some variation of that sales concept, right? And I believe he mentioned a very old life insurance company like New York Life got mm-hmm. it right off their website. Okay.
That's the company I worked for 2 weeks. Listen,
boy, dropping some peel behind this curtain right here, man. Okay.
7 years ago.
Yeah. And you know, others, he walked away from it on his own volition, right? And he still has a New York Life policy. I've tried to buy it. He won't sell it to me. Maybe we can make a deal where if I die, I'll give it back to you. I don't know. I'm just saying. Okay. That's beside the point.
Looking forward to that estate planning conversation.
Yeah. Right. Okay. And then it makes me want to bring up another point, right? If you were an agent for New York Life Insurance and you're no longer an agent for New York Life Insurance, you know as well as I do, it's because you couldn't sell. Right. Because, and not only could you not sell, you couldn't train, because generally if you can't sell, they move you up to training. Right. Now I know all you New York Life guys are going to like.
He's just picking on you. I'm a former New York Life guy. So it's.
You walked away by your own, with your own. You were asked to leave. You were asked to return. You walked away on your own volition.
Yeah. And I'm friends with the guy who used to run the GO. And,
right. Can he spell IBC? Anyway, I don't know him. I'm sure he's a great guy. No. And I digress. All right. Okay. Here is what stands out to me. You have one of the oldest life insurance company that continually exists in North America. All right. And their motto here to sell is protection, accumulation, and distribution. This is what stands out to me and where it takes my thinking. And they, like many of the other companies, including some of the ones that we're agents for, have morphed into, over the last 30, 40 years, the fabrication in their own mind. They've morphed into, they want to be these entities that are all things to all people, a financial services firm. Talk about broad. Yeah. What the hell does that mean? Well, they've tried mortgages.
What doesn't
they've
mean?
They've tried all kinds. A financial services firm, right? So we can, provide all of these products for everyone, no matter what stage in life they're in. And they've adopted the protection, accumulation, and distribution. And I assure you that if there's any training, sales training that exists in the life insurance industry, it exists. If it exists in the home office of a life insurance company, it exists in that company and a couple of others.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
All right. And they have the Monday morning meetings, what'd you sell, what'd you deliver, blah, blah, blah. Well, you're falling short.
It was for
you
me.
Here's your quota. I'm going to have to talk to you. You're going to have a side conversation. Okay. And hence my comment that, if you were previously a New York Life Insurance agent, and of course the out would be, I'll give you like a afforded Ryan, which is in fact true in his case. He left on his own volition. You couldn't sell life insurance. You couldn't meet their standards or their quotas. And since you couldn't do that, they couldn't move you up to train. They ask you to leave.
Yeah, they do cut you. Like if you
they
can't.
Do, I'm telling you. Yeah. Okay. So James, what are you saying? This is what I'm saying. Here they are trying to be all things to all people. And the very idea that protection, is that insurance in the financial world? Of course.
Term.
Accumulation. Excellent. Of course, they have annuities and they have equities and they own the stock coming, all of that.
Mutual funds, ETFs.
Yeah. They got it all, right. And then distribution, income, annuities.
Help you draw it down.
Withdrawal.
Collect fees until that time. Yeah.
And I've encouraged them all, and I've had the opportunity several times to encourage them, face to face, and I never miss the opportunity to go down to your freaking basement, go down to your archives, and dig a little deeper. Understand who you are, who you were, and identify with that. Mm-hmm. Because with life insurance, with the appropriate design, for you individually, I don't know what other product in the financial world that you could deliver this protection, accumulation, and distribution. I don't know what other product could possibly exist that could outperform a properly designed life insurance policy issued by a mutual company.
It's, no, I mean, notice
ironic.
What, yeah. Notice what else isn't there, right? Protection, accumulation, distribution. Providing for capital.
No question. That's the accumulation. No. That's, of course, the banking function is never mentioned. We pointed that out many times. And the accumulate, they're going to do what they do to deliver on what they contractually are obligated to deliver upon. Right? Okay. Oh, and it's private property and all the characteristics that it has. And the capital that I have access to, if I accumulate properly, can outperform the product, right? Which, oh my gosh, does that mean we got to be dragged off into the weeds, Mr. Griggs, and talk about rates of return, ROI, ROR, ROR, rate of return, rate on investment, return on investment?
I think any of those metrics that one might like to employ is just a way to sort of artificially cap one what one's capable of doing. To close out for me.
He must be hungry. I'm ready to go. You know, I was recording an hour and a half yesterday, well, and I'm like, the guys are cutting off the lights. I'm like, I've been thrown out of better places than this. I'm not ready to quit. Okay.
I will throw out a couple carrots for people who have made it this far on the foundation front. You just go read IRS publication 557. Might be interesting. And maybe you see a little bit better what I mean when I say that it's, I think where all of this the truly perpetual capitalistic planning, strategizing goes.
How many carrots are you going to throw out, Mr. Griggs? And how far out into the future might these carrots be available?
Well, no pressure. It depends on the availability of somebody to work on them together. But no, I mean, they'll come eventually because.
Are you a life insurance agent? Oh my gosh, that was such a non answer.
It depends. Yeah.
I'm kidding.
But yeah, go. That's what I, you know, check that out. And I, what just tickles me, I just get so, you know, the people with the many, 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 many letters after their names, right? And they're all tax planners, right? Because they're all going to help mitigate your tax liability, which for them really just means create larger liabilities in the future. None of them ever know a thing about irrevocable charitable trusts. I'm like, how can...
That's not true, man. He didn't have all the designation behind his name, but I've listened to a couple of TikTokers lately out of their car telling you exactly how to structure that and why.
They wouldn't know the difference between an irrevocable and irrevocable trust. I've had clients come to me, you know, ask about, you know, what should I put the life insurance in a trust? I'm like, y'all know trusts pay income tax, right?
Like, what?
What? Oh, and the rates are all high. Like you hit the top rate that is the personal income tax rate at like 13 grand in income.
It started 45%.
I don't know. Last time I looked.
Well, okay, look at the tax code. It's pretty damn high.
12 or 13,000 in income, you hit the top bracket. They're very high. It's higher than it is for a personal, for an individual. So it's like, yeah, it's like half true, right? Like, yeah, you don't pay the tax personally, but it's not that the tax doesn't get paid. It doesn't eliminate the tax. It shifts it from you to this trust that it's like, so it's still money you're creating that you're paying. Anyway, don't know anything about the charitable context. And the charitable context, just ask all of the corrupt politicians, is where the best tax benefits are. So why doesn't anybody ever look at it? And it's a product of common law, of trust law. It's not corporate. So it doesn't require the government's permission. So anyway, I'll stop. I mean, there's more where that came from, but yeah. That's what I'm excited about. And yes, I am hungry.
Okay. I had fun as usual, as I always do. Thank you for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed it.
Bye, y'all.
See you next time. Peace.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.